day, and welcome to the Arcturus Therapeutics KOL on OTC conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Neda Safarzadeh. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator, and hello everyone, and thank you for joining us. The call today will feature a presentation by key opinion leader Dr. Annette Feigenbaum from UC San Diego, who will discuss the disease pathogenesis, manifestation, natural history, and current treatment options for OTC deficiency. Dr. Pat Chivukula, Chief Scientific Officer of Arcturus Therapeutics, will also provide a brief overview of the company's LUNAR OTC program, which utilizes our proprietary LUNAR delivery platform to safely and effectively deliver OTC mRNA to liver cells, resulting in restoration of disease markers to normal levels. Both Dr. Feigenbaum and Dr. Chivukula, as well as our President and CEO, Joe Payne, will be available to address questions at the conclusion of the call. There are slides accompanying today's call, and in order to view these, please go to Investor Relations section of our website, click on Events and Presentation, and you will see the link. The link is also in the press release we issued on December 3rd. Before we begin, I would like to remind everyone that the presentation and the Q&A session contain forward-looking statements as defined in the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Forward-looking statements include, but are not limited to, statements about the following. Any statements other than statements of historical fact included in this call regarding strategy, future operations, collaborations, future financial position, prospects, plans, and objectives of management are forward-looking statements. Arcturus may not actually achieve the plans, carry out the intentions, or meet the expectations or projections disclosed in any forward-looking statements, and you should not place undue reliance on such forward-looking statements. Actual results and performance could differ materially from those projected in any forward-looking statements as a result of many factors, including without limitation, an inability to develop and market product candidates. Such statements are based on management's current expectations and involve risks and uncertainties, including those disclosed under the heading Risk Factors in Arcturus' annual report on Form 20-F for the fiscal year ended December 31, 2017, filed with the SEC on May 14, 2018, and in subsequent filing with or submissions to the SEC. Except as otherwise required by law, Arcturus disclaims any intention or obligation to update or revise any forward-looking statements which speak only as of the date they were made, whether as a result of new information, future events, or circumstances, or otherwise. This conference call is the property of Arcturus and LifeSci Advisors, and any recording or rebroadcast is expressly prohibited without the written consent of these parties. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Joe Payne, co-founder, president, and CEO of Arcturus Therapeutics, for a few introductory remarks.
Hey, thank you, Neda, and thank you everyone for joining us today on the call. Our call today is going to be focused on our preclinical program for ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. Before I turn the time over to Dr. I think it would be helpful to give you a very brief overview of Arcturus and exactly what it is we do. The first slide is it shows our pipeline. Arcturus is a messenger RNA therapeutics company. We have technologies that have the ability to safely and effectively deliver RNA medicines. And now this is important because RNA control or modulate how genes are expressed. And we have a diverse pipeline here of RNA therapeutics, including programs focused on rare diseases, including cystic fibrosis, also large patient population diseases like hepatitis B and NASH. And also, while we are not a vaccine company, we can enable RNA vaccine technologies like the RNA Replicon vaccine program that we have in our pipeline. Five of these programs are being developed through collaborations with Johnson & Johnson, Takeda, Ultragenyx, and Synthetic Genomics. Our cystic fibrosis program is wholly owned and externally funded in large part by the CF Foundation. Now, shifting our attention to the top line on the pipeline, our OTC deficiency program is being successfully developed with CureVac in a 50-50 cost-sharing collaboration. CureVac is an excellent partner with a strong reputation and storied history in messenger RNA therapeutics. We're happy to be working with them on the exciting program. We have a we've got strong intellectual property and an extensive patent portfolio. It protects our chemistry, our messenger RNA manufacturing processes, and of course our lunar lipid mediated delivery and formulation process and technologies. You can see our strategic partners at the bottom of this slide. You know, prior to transitioning to becoming a public company on NASDAQ, 80% of our funding was provided by our strategic partners. We are very appreciative of these relationships that we've established in the pharmaceutical community, and we definitely look forward to 2019. Today's call is focused on Arcturus's most advanced research program, which addresses TC deficiency. Now, this is a life-threatening genetic disease. It affects approximately 1 in 60,000 people. It's the most common urea cycle disorder. And as mentioned, we are collaborating with our partner CureVac program, wherein we aim to develop a messenger RNA replacement therapy that's designed to simply enable these OTC-deficient patients naturally produce healthy functional OTC enzyme in their own liver cells. And we've achieved preclinical proof of concept with Lunar OTC. We've demonstrated that Lunar technology can deliver messenger RNA to liver cells in animal models. And our IND submission goal for Lunar OTC remains on track for the second half of 2019. Now, to help those listening on the call today understand more about the biology of OTC deficiency and the current treatment landscape, it's our pleasure to have on today Dr. Annette Feigenbaum. Now, Dr. Feigenbaum is a clinical geneticist. She's based here, right here in San Diego. She's an associate physician in the Department of Pediatrics and Biochemical Genetics at Brady Children's Hospital in the University of California, San Diego. She has spent a lot of time, in fact, the majority of her career, researching and treating patients with inborn errors of metabolism and has specific interest in urea disorders. She has authored numerous papers on this area of medical genetics. She served as the site principal investigator for multiple clinical research studies in diseases and also PKU and mitochondrial disease. So following Dr. Feigenbaum, our co-founder and chief scientific officer, Dr. Adchip, will share some exciting data and go into further detail on our lunar program. I will now turn the call to Annette. Dr. Feigenbaum, please go ahead. And Dr. Feigenbaum, Are you on the line or are you on mute by chance?
Oh, my goodness. I was on mute and speaking to myself.
Hey, I've never done that before, ever. I'm joking. Hey, thanks for coming back. Great. Go ahead.
I apologize. So we're on slide number 6, and I'll be indicating the slide changes. It's my pleasure to speak to you this morning and hopefully indicate to you the need for something new in urea cycle disorder treatments. Next slide, 7. I'm going to speak, as Ned mentioned to you, a brief introduction to urea cycle and OTC deficiency for those of you that do not know about this area, the pathogenesis and disease manifestations, as well as the natural history and treatment. Slide 8. This slide indicates to you at the bottom NH4. Next slide, please. NH4, which is ammonia. Ammonia is a normal constituent of all body fluids and is generated from the catabolism or breakdown of nucleotides and amino acids, which come from both dietary protein and breakdown of body protein. It is a neurotoxin and is converted to water-soluble urea by the urea cycle for excretion in the urine, as shown in the next slide, number 9. In this slide, I've indicated the urea cycle in the liver on the top left, and ornithine transcarbamylase is in the box, the green box in the mitochondria. But also to indicate that certain areas of the urea cycle are active in the muscle, kidney, and gastrointestinal system. So we need to take all these areas into account when we're talking about treatment. However, for OTC deficiency, this is localized to the liver. Next slide, number 10. In a little bit more detail, in the shaded area, pink on the top left, you will see above the red bar, OTC. This is ornithine transcarbamylase enzyme, which combines ornithine and carbamoyl phosphate to form citrulline, which then enters the urea cycle. And the bottom left in yellow, you'll see urea is generated. Many enzyme deficiencies have been described in this area of metabolism, and the 6 main enzymes I've indicated in the box on the right-hand side with their abbreviation. So OTC, the third down, ornithine transcarbamylase. I also wanted to show you the interaction with other metabolic pathways, such as the tricarboxylic or TCA cycle on the right, as well as pyrimidine biosynthesis pathway. And I draw your attention to orotic acid, which is elevated in the urine and blood of individuals and animal models with OTC deficiency and can be used as a biochemical marker as well as the ammonia. Next slide, 11. Joe mentioned to you the incidence of OTC deficiency and other urea cycle defects, depending on which article you read, it's somewhere between 1 in 56 and 77,000 for OTC deficiency, but clearly OTC deficiency is the most common urea cycle defect. The prevalence seems to be about 10,000, which gives us some idea of what we're dealing with. These numbers are from 2013, updated in 2015. Next slide, 12. OTC deficiency is the only enzyme in the urea cycle that is inherited on the X chromosome. And for this, we always understood that the carrier mother, who has 2 X chromosomes, may not be severely affected, but has a 50% chance of passing that X chromosome to her daughter, who then would be a carrier similar to her, or her son, who would then be affected since there's only one X chromosome. We now know that there are milder forms of OTC deficiency where the father can also transmit the X chromosome to his daughters and cause them to be affected or carriers of OTC deficiency. There are a number of different modifying factors. The major one in X-linked inheritance is an entity called lionization, where only one X chromosome is active in each cell and the other is inactivated. This is a random fixed inactivation and occurs early in development. So we consider that the degree to which females are affected is based not only on the severity of the mutation, but also the degree of lionization or the lionization pattern in different tissues or cells. But there's large phenotypic heterogeneity observed among patients with OTC mutations, even among members of the same family. So one considers that there are also environmental factors and genetic modifiers which need to be better understood, and better genotype-phenotype correlations are needed as we face with many metabolic diseases. Next slide, number 13. Shows a pedigree of a family affected by a full deletion of the OTC gene, and the arrow indicates the proband who presented with neonatal coma, the circle is a female, So females can present also with severe disease and very low enzyme activity. She died. Her asymptomatic mother, who carries the same mutation, had not even orotic aciduria after a high protein load. And her grandmother, in her maternal grandmother, displayed only increased orotic acid. But her two brothers died in the neonatal period with unexplained coma assumed to be OTC deficiency. So very variable manifestations, even in the same family with the same mutation. Next, slide 14. The diagnosis is made by an index of suspicion measuring ammonia and amino acid levels as well as orotic acid levels. And nowadays, mainstay of a diagnosis is DNA analysis. This is a diagram from Paldovic's article in 2015 showing missense and nonsense mutations across the gene, the codon numbers on the bottom, and the number of mutations that they described on the y-axis. Suffice to say that the mutations are found spread across the gene. There are no particular hotspots, both in exons and introns. But in addition to this, there are RNA splicing defects and premature protein terminations and deletions affecting this gene. Next slide. 15. I should mention that one can do enzyme activity. We have always done this in the past with an invasive test, including a liver biopsy, but people are working on blood analysis to measure enzyme activity. So the manifestations of OTC deficiency are variable, as I indicated, and this is an example of a male with neonatal onset disease. He presented with high ammonia, leading to acute encephalopathy and seizures and eventually coma. On the left is an MRI scan, and on the right an autopsy sample showing gross destruction of the brain tissue with cystic lesions throughout. So very severe manifestation of the disease. Even with early treatment, it is very difficult to achieve a normal outcome in neonatal male onset. Next, slide 16. There are also males who present with late onset where the mutation results in some residual enzyme activity. These males can present at any age and can present with the neurological symptoms due to high ammonia or other toxins, levels like glutamine, but also psychiatric phenotypes, unexplained changes in mental status, and can be unmasked by stress situations. And these include medications such as steroids, valproic acid, anesthetic agents, and chemotherapeutic agents. The brain damage, even in these late-onset milder cases, can be irreversible, and one really needs a way to recognize these patients early. Some of them are completely asymptomatic until a severe hyperammonemic episode. So genetic counseling and prognostication is difficult. Next, slide 17. In the females with OTC deficiency, as is obvious, one can be asymptomatic or have onset of symptoms at any age, from severe neonatal to later onset milder hyperammonemia to neuropsychiatric symptoms. And again, the triggers can be due to infection, diet changes, changes in growth, stress, medications that I've mentioned. Even the menstrual cycle can lead to symptoms with resorption of blood from the menses or fasting for surgery. And there have been some cases who have presented after bariatric surgery, gastric bypass. Many of the individuals avoid protein and self-restrict protein, and there are nutritional complications as well. About 15 to 20% of females can manifest with symptoms, is the current feeling. Next, slide 18. So the toxin that's involved in the urea cycle defect, including OTC deficiency, is considered to be mainly ammonia, but there are many downstream effects, as indicated in the slide, and I'm not going to take you through all of it. But suffice to say that there are changes in neurotransmitters. There's brain swelling due to elevated glutamine and disruption of mitochondrial energy metabolism, calcium signaling, oxidative stress, etc. And some of this could be due to glutamine or other toxins that we don't fully understand, including cytokines. Next slide, 19. I've alluded to the prognosis in urea cycle defects. There is a high rate of morbidity and mortality. The Urea Cycle Disease Consortium, which is a multi-center study through the Rare Diseases Consortium at NIH and Washington, quotes a mortality rate of 24% in the neonatal onset and 11% in the late onset cases. This is improving as medical techniques improve and liver transplant becomes easier, but we definitely need better interventions. The long-term outcome can include developmental delay, mental retardation, stroke-like episodes, learning difficulties, including attention deficit behavior issues, as well as neurological issues such as ataxia, spasticity, and seizures. There's also ongoing liver abnormalities, including fibrosis, and some of the patients even present with overt liver failure, which seems to be transient during the acute episode. Even asymptomatic females have cognitive deficits that can place them at increased risk for learning disabilities and attention deficit, and we have now identified changes on MRI, brain scans, and MR spectroscopy that show biochemical changes even in the so-called asymptomatic females. Next slide, 20. So as these patients survive, we have to address long-term issues. There's always the risk of hyperammonemia, either due to intercurrent infection or other stresses, or for unknown reasons. The long-term developmental delays and psychiatric symptoms, the liver damage, and severe, often, if we don't pay close attention, nutritional problems due to the diet that we have to initiate in the symptomatic patients. There's an ongoing risk of stroke-like episodes, even in the absence of severe hyperammonemia, and some females have now been described with hepatocellular carcinoma, so there seems to be some risk, but this is being studied. Next slide, 21. The emergency management of hyperammonemia is the same, essentially the same for all the urea cycle defects. There's some subtle manipulations that we make, but basically we withdraw protein for a short time and we supply a lot of calories with sugar and fat intravenously to prevent body catabolism of proteins, and we rely a lot on pharmacological agents. And I've mentioned a couple here, aminol, which is an intravenous preparation, sodium phenylbutyrate, trade name Bufenol, sodium benzoate, and glycerol phenylbutyrate, or Ravicti. These bind amino acids and therefore eliminate an amino group. In the case of phenylbutyrate, it binds with glutamine to form phenylacetylglutamine, which is non-toxic and excreted in the urine, and benzoate binds with glycine to form hippuric acid. We also rely on hemodialysis if the ammonia is very high or the patient is in coma with cerebral edema. And that works successfully to achieve some degree of recovery, but is not the answer in the long term. Next slide, 22. The chronic management of ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency includes severe diet limitations, supplementation with special amino acid formulas and low-protein foods, supplementation with amino acids. In the case of OTC deficiency, we use citrulline. We use the scavengers that I've just mentioned. Many patients need G-tube or feeding tubes and central lines, and we admit them for any intercurrent illness to try and prevent catabolism. Many of the patients who are symptomatic are now undergoing liver transplantation, which is also being studied. but other modalities such as liver cell infusion as a bridge to transplant, chaperones, and now coming gene therapy and modification of intestinal microbiome is being attempted, and I'll mention that at the end of this talk. So slide 23 gives you some idea of the diet that the symptomatic patients are subjected to. They have to eliminate all high-protein foods from their diet, which includes dairy, fish, meat, eggs, and really limits even bread. Regular bread has protein in it, as well as legumes. So it really limits their daily activities, their social life, and their general nutrition. Next slide, 24. This is a slide from the same article I quoted before, which shows the neurocognitive outcomes in females and males who participated in the longitudinal study of the consortium that I mentioned. On the left-hand side, the IQ scores of the neonatal onset females, as well as late onset females and asymptomatic females are indicated, and on most of the female subjects had average or above average IQ. On the right-hand side is the IQ scores of the neonatal onset males, late onset males, and asymptomatic males. And in these participants, earlier disease onset is associated with poorer neurocognitive outcome. So this is just based on the IQ scores. There are many better modalities and tests to identify other neuropsychological deficits. The gray bar, horizontal shaded area in the graphs, is the normal IQ for the general population. Next slide, 25. This shows the symptoms of patients who submitted a survey and their caretakers who submitted a survey of patients who are on phenylbutyrate therapy. Many of them continue to experience symptoms, including gastrointestinal symptoms, nausea, vomiting, decreased appetite, stomach ache, general fatigue, heartburn, etc., as well as other symptoms, which I'll describe in the next slide. This is a significant impact on daily life and definitely seems to be a barrier to adherence, not only to the diet, but also the medications that we give that may have side effects. So I'll go on to the next slide, which is slide 26. And this shows some improvement in the black bars of the bar diagram after changing from phenylbutyrate to glycerol phenylbutyrate or Ravicti, and this was very encouraging. We do see marked improvement in their symptoms. However, some patients really do not improve and others even worsen, both in the top bar diagram for the gastrointestinal symptoms and in the bottom for non-GI symptoms such as dizziness, fatigue, menstrual irregularities, headache, etc. So we still have work to do to try and improve life for these individuals. Next slide, 27. I've been asked to speak a little bit about the past history of OTC therapy, including gene therapy, and some of you may be familiar with the Jesse Gelsinger story, which dated back a number of decades now, where Jim Wilson and Mark Batchel attempted second and third generation adenoviral vector therapy. The preclinical studies, including primates, seemed to indicate promising results, although some deaths occurred in the primates. But in 1997, the FDA approved a dose escalation phase 1 trial. Over 2.5 years, 15 subjects were submitted to increasing dose of vector, and they experienced only mild adverse events, but reaching cohort 6 at the higher dose, the second case was Jesse, who developed an acute inflammatory reaction after dosing and, despite some heroic measures, died after 98 hours, and the trial was stopped. The issues identified with the process and possible things that could be improved in a gene therapy trial were nicely outlined by Jim Wilson in 2009. Hepatic cell infusion has also been used and worked as a bridge to transplant in some patients. I'm not aware of a current trial in place. The next slide, 28, is my last slide. To outline the current pipeline as I'm aware of it in OTC deficiency therapy, Ultragenyx, one of the partners for Arcturus, is trying gene therapy using AAV8 vector in adults with late onset OTC deficiency. We hope that this will improve the outcome of the patients in the early phase trials. 1 in 3 of each cohort of dosage showed increased ureagenesis and came off scavengers at 6 weeks. The other 2 of the 3 were not as encouraging, but they plan to continue to cohort 3 and a long-term extension study. Two companies that I'm aware of, Synlogic and Kaleido, are using microbiome manipulation in an attempt to reduce the ammonia load on the urea cycle. An investigator-initiated study was submitted to clinical trials for the use of lithostat, which interferes with urea-splitting organisms in the urine, but I haven't seen any follow-up reports to that. And then finally, to mention mRNA studies, including Arcturus's lipid nanoparticles, the company Translate Bio is also planning a mRNA lipid nanoparticle study in OTC deficiency with phase 1 or 2 and 1 and 2 studies planned for the first half of 2019. I will now turn over the call to Dr. Pad Chivukula, who will discuss the work that is ongoing at Arcturus to develop an RNA treatment for OTC deficiency. He is the Chief Scientific Officer for the company. Thank you.
Thank you for that fantastic introduction, Dr. Feigenbaum. Now I will be switching gears and... I think we're getting a little bit of feedback, but I think we're okay now. Now I'll be switching gears and talking about the work that we have been conducting for the last few years on a novel class of therapies based on messenger RNA. Messenger RNA by itself is very unstable and needs to be protected from extracellular enzymes in vivo, otherwise it would be degraded rapidly. To this end, we have utilized our proprietary delivery technology called LUNAR to protect the mRNA and deliver it to specific tissues. For LUNAR, truly unlocks the potential for messenger RNA. Development of safe and effective strategies for the liver, lung, intramuscular targeted mRNA delivery aims to open a host of therapeutic possibilities. As you can see on this slide, this includes, but not limited to, transporters, enzymes, antibodies, and receptors. The complex function of the liver, which includes intermediate metabolites of carbohydrates, lipids, amino acids, and the detoxification of toxic metabolites, opens up a host of therapeutic possibilities previously undruggable due to proteins. Using LUNAR, each of these proteins can be introduced in a transient manner to provide control RNA therapeutics in a safe way to give doctors the flexibility in dosing and treating their patients. Most of all, we believe this can create significant new opportunities to develop therapeutics in multiple disease areas. Next slide. This slide shows the LUNAR mechanism of delivery and is depicted in 4 steps. First, LUNAR particle associated with the cell membrane of the desired tissue cell type. Second, the LUNAR particle fuses the cell membrane, causing internalization of the nucleic acid particle complex. This forms an endosomal vesicle. The LUNAR particles are designed to escape the endosome and release the mRNA into the cytoplasm using a pH-mediated disruption mechanism, followed by biodegradation of the lipid inside the cell. The biodegradable nature of the lipid excipients is a key differentiating factor of the LUNAR technology and allows for high doses and improved safety profile. Preclinical studies in several mouse models and in non-human primates have shown that LUNAR can deliver both messenger RNA and siRNA in vivo to clinically important cells and tissues. Next slide. On this slide, we show the specificity of LUNAR technology. The figure on the left is a proof of concept experiment with LUNAR nanoparticles incorporating with luciferase messenger RNA. The IVIS image that you see shows an IV-injected mRNA can be safely protected in the bloodstream, and the RNA can be delivered to the liver for transient protein expression. The figure on the right shows the LUNAR encapsulated GFP messenger RNA. Here, we wanted to take a look at liver section by histology. The image shows uniform distribution and diffuse fluorescence of GFP throughout the liver, resembling hepatocyte targeting. Next slide. This slide depicts the advantages of LUNAR-mediated delivery. This, again, is a versatile, diverse, biodegradable platform which can be manufactured efficiently. These particles can be formulated with multiple RNA modalities and can be administered IV, IM, or nebulized for local expression. We can also target these particles to hepatocytes, stellate cells, myocytes, and lung epithelial cells. Together with a biodegradable system and our manufacturing expertise, we generate a scalable, reproducible drug. Next slide. Here, we demonstrate our scalability and reproducibility with specific examples. Manufacturing plays a key role in messenger RNA delivery, and we're happy to report that our current process can support early research scale to development. We can effectively encapsulate milligram to multigram scales of drug product. This figure shows that we have uniform particles starting from 50 milligrams all the way up to 30 grams. We have repeated the 30-gram scale multiple times and report similar particle size and encapsulation. This is a key milestone for our platform. Going to the next slide. LUNAR nanoparticles also demonstrate robust stability for up to 12 months. We have looked at particle size, percent encapsulation, RNA purity for up to 12 months, and all of these remain unchanged. Next slide. LUNAR particles can encapsulate mRNA of various sizes, from very small RNAs, which are 20 nucleotides in length, all the way up to 12,000 nucleotides. This is a key advantage of our system that differentiates us from viral vectors, where they have limited capacity to encapsulate the DNA molecule. Because of this, we believe we can go after diseases that AAV viral vector technology cannot currently address. Going to the next slide. This slide shows the Arcturus proprietary mRNA manufacturing process. Our mRNA drug substance includes a cap, a 5' UTR, a 3' UTR, the coding sequence, and a poly A tail. Arcturus has a proprietary UTR library that's used to optimize protein expression and mRNA stability. We have also optimized the capping procedure as well as identified the optimal poly A length, and a proprietary codon optimization algorithm is used to enhance protein expression. Going to the next slide. On this slide, it shows the Arcturus mRNA manufacturing process, which starts with a DNA template, followed by an in vitro transcription process. We end with our proprietary purification process and buffer exchange. All of these procedures reduce cost and generate a very high PR product. Our process has been optimized to reduce reaction time and can accommodate scaling kilogram quantities. Going to the next slide. One of the big challenges for messenger RNA delivery technology is the translatability from mouse to non-human primate. In this experiment, the proof of concept a secreted protein, namely the protein erythropoietin, or EPO, is used to detect the concentration of protein in the blood after a single administration. As you can see on the graph on the left and right, we have very good correlation between a mouse and non-human primate. At a low dose of encapsulated EPO, we can produce significant amounts of protein measured in the plasma. The amount of protein produced is multiple orders greater than that of the physiological level. At these doses, lunar particles was well tolerated, and we see significant PD to the presence of the protein. Next slide. Another challenge with messenger therapeutics is the sustained expression after repeat dosing. On this slide, we show the sustained EPO expression upon repeat dosing in non-human primates. As you can see, two doses of human EPO given weekly or biweekly IV administration in non-human primates, we see sustained expression without loss in activity. Again, this was a key milestone for the company. And the data was generated a few years ago. Go to the next slide. In the previous slides, we showed the expression of secreted protein. Next, we wanted to ensure that this word translates to an intracellular protein. We also wanted to use an intracellular protein that would be that would have very low background expression as we were going into wild-type animals. To this end, we synthesized a red fluorescent protein mRNA and encapsulated the RNA in LUNAR. This nanoparticle was infused into NHPs, and we detected the liver expression in the liver. We detected expression in the liver. And the figure on the left is a control animal, and we don't detect any RF protein signal as expected. And the one on the right, you can clearly see uniform expression of RFP with an immunohistochemistry stain throughout the liver. This was a great proof of concept for our delivery platform. Next slide. In the next few slides, I'll be showing you data on our mRNA therapy for ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. Again, we had a great introduction to this by Dr. Feigenbaum, so I won't spend a lot of time. We know there is a limited treatment options available for many inherited metabolic diseases, which are typically caused by single gene defects. While protein replacement is an effective approach, it can be limited due to obstacles associated with targeting the protein to the intracellular compartment of a cell. Nucleic acid medicines such as gene therapy and mRNA have overcome these obstacles by entering the cell and initiating normal intracellular protein production in vivo, theoretically treating any diseases caused by protein dysfunction. Next slide. This slide addresses the OTC market opportunity. Urea cycle disorders make it difficult to remove byproducts such as when proteins are digested, causing ammonia concentration to rise in the bloodstream, which can result in serious metabolic crisis characterized by vomiting, progressive lethargy, irreversible neurological damage, or death. Ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, most common urea cycle disorders, is associated with severe hyperammonemia, accompanied by high risk of neurological damage and death in patients presenting with the neonatal. OTCD is characterized by lack of the enzyme in transcarbamylase, which is again a trimeric mitochondrial protein, and the loss of which results in an inability to detoxify and remove from blood the ammonia that's produced protein. It's a difficult disease to manage, requires constant monitoring, and a very restrictive diet. LUNAR OTC aims to the enzyme function, preventing neurological damage, and removing the need for liver transplantation. Next slide. This slide highlights the advantage of mRNA therapeutics versus an AAV viral vector. Gene therapy typically results in a permanent change to the cellular DNA that could lead to long-term safety concerns. AAV therapy requires 5 years follow-up which could significantly enhance development times. mRNA allows for dose titration, even twisted distribution, and repeat dosing. Furthermore, some gene therapy delivery vehicles are associated with immune response that can limit the ability to repeat and prevent dose titrations. Going to the next slide. On this slide, we have demonstrated the durability of codon-optimized OTC mRNA in vitro and in vivo. The slide on the left shows OTC mRNA transfected into primary human hepatocytes localized to the mitochondria. We have further confirmed that the protein is active using an enzymatic potency assay. And the slide on the right shows OTC protein expression in wild-type mouse liver after lunar OTC treatment. We are developing an intravenous administered therapeutic coding for the OTC mRNA in our lunar technology in order to restore the defective mitochondrial enzyme. We have observed preclinical proof of concept in wild-type mice that significant amounts of protein can be produced after a single IV administration. Additionally, in this study, we show that the wild-type mouse human OTC levels can be elevated above that of the levels found in a mouse. Next slide. The key question we wanted to address was the tropism of the lunar technology. It's well known that wild-type OTC has higher expression in periportal hepatocytes. We wanted to ensure that our particles were getting clinically important area. On this slide, we have observed preclinical proof of concept in an OTC mouse model, namely the FCF-ASH mouse model, that at three different doses, we have observed dose-dependent increase in expression in periportal hepatocytes, which is the main site for ureagenesis, the levels of which appear to be approaching wild-type amounts. Again, clinical evidence suggests as 5% of normal enzyme activity is sufficient to ameliorate the severe neonatal phenotype, making OTC deficiency ideal model for the development of a liver-targeted mRNA therapeutics. Our approach could be a transformational way to treat this disease. Next slide. On this slide, again, in the FCF-ASH mouse model, we show a marked improvement in survival and reduction of the biochemical abnormalities in the study. Figure on the left shows treatment of FCF-ASH mice with lunar OTC suppressed the disease biomarker, urinary orotate, for a duration of 2 weeks. And the figure on the right shows significant improvement in survival in these mice post-protein challenge. This therapy has the potential to restore the normal physiology of the cell and correcting not only OTCD, but is broadly applicable to other rare diseases other rare liver diseases. To summarize this data, lunar OTC delivered human mRNA reduces urinary orotate levels in a well-established mouse model of OTC deficiency. Weekly dosing of lunar OTC protects the mice from high-protein diet, induced hyperammonemia, and death. And a low dose of just 0.3 mg per kg of weekly dosing was sufficient to protect the mice after the second dose. Going to the next slide. So in summary, we want to say the lunar delivered platform enables all RNA medicines. In vivo proof of concept was achieved with lunar OTC with our program. Lunar's proprietary manufacturing process for drug substance and drug product are poised to drive programs into their development. Again, we want to reiterate we're on track for an IND submission for the second half of 2019. Going to the next slide. Joe already presented this slide, but again, this is reiterate our pipeline of RNA medicines that we are working on, and we are very grateful to be working with our partner, CureVac, on this program, and we are looking forward to providing more updates in the new year. Thank you very much for your time. Now we can take questions. Joe?
Turn it over to the operator to address some questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. We will now take our first question from Wang Zhen Li of Ladenburg. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. Thanks for the very helpful introduction. And one question is about the target population. So the doctor mentioned the neonatal onset is very severe symptoms, and for a lot of patients, looks like the symptoms are irreversible. So I just wondering, any additional color on either gene therapy or the lunar messenger RNA therapy, can they, what kind of patients you can treat, and can they just stabilize disease or reverse, you know, the symptoms?
Good question.
Pat, why don't you take it?
Hi, Wingzi. No, that's a great question. You know, obviously, we would like to treat patients with the highest unmet need, and that is the neonatal population. But we intend to get some initial proof of concept data in a stable population, and then we will be ultimately looking to see if this therapeutic is applicable to that population.
Got it. So realize that for the phase one trial, I mean the IND is next year. Just wondering, is this the initial study will be a healthy volunteer, or you can directly go to patient?
You know, that's something that we are currently discussing and internally strategizing, and we'll provide more guidance on that relatively soon.
Okay, got it. My last question is, you showed very impressive data, showed a very homogeneous expression across the liver, but I'm wondering, in the human, do you have any thoughts on what percentage of liver you need to be transduced or, you know, to express the messenger RNA to correct the disease? My thinking is, you know, if there are cells not expressing the enzyme, they will still produce the ammonia, right? So I guess it depends on what percentage of cells need to correct it to really lower the ammonia significant to a non-toxic level. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, at least from the preclinical model data that we've been generating, of course, we are making significant amount of protein. And we believe that only a small percentage of cells need to be expressing the enzyme. As you know, there has been other trials, and it is well understood that only 5% of enzyme activity is needed potentially to correct this disease. So 5 to 10% is the number.
I would add in a comment too, Pat, that you know, we consider it positive that the data that we've seen that with respect to the biodistribution of the lunar technology throughout these preclinical models is very promising as well, especially in the periportal region of the liver, which is where ureagenesis resides, and a lot of activity is seen from our urea cycle-related activity. Whether this translates cleanly into humans is yet to be, you know, that data is yet to be collected. Consider it very promising that we've seen, you know, nice coverage and broad distribution, including the periportal region of the liver, in preclinical models.
Yeah, I was very impressed to see that such a homogeneous expression across the liver in both the mice and the monkeys. So look forward to the human data. And thanks for answering my question.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Aki Naki of Chardon. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, thanks. Two questions. First, the strong affinity you're showing for the periportal region. Are you doing anything specific in the design of the construct to achieve that, or is that simply a function of the anatomy?
Go ahead, Pat.
No, that's a good question. You know, what, before we did the experiment, we weren't sure of, you know, where exactly we, you know, these particles were being delivered. But clearly, I think the central vein is also a key area. But there is some delivery to the central region of the liver. But we were, of course, very excited to see the uptake into the periportal region.
Okay.
Go ahead, Joe.
No, I agree with Pat. Go ahead with the second question.
Could you describe what the key remaining tasks are that you need to complete before you can file the IND?
Sure. There needs to be a formal announcement of a preclinical candidate that gets communicated. And then we have to engage in the manufacturing of the drug substance and the drug product, utilizing our proprietary processes. And engage in the IND enabling studies. Pat, anything to add?
Yeah, no, and we're on track for all those things in the near term.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
We will now take our next question from a Yale Jen. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, and thanks for taking the questions. Just first question is that I just want to make sure that the first clinical study will be in the late onset patient instead of in the neonate. Is that correct?
We haven't given guidance on exactly our clinical strategy yet, but of course, going into neonate directly would be a challenge, right? So I think you're right.
No, that's right. Yeah, we haven't disclosed our clinical strategy, and you are correct that the neonate is where there's the highest unmet medical need, and we want to strive to dose those patients as soon as possible.
Okay, great. Maybe two more quick ones. The next one is that based on your rodent studies, do you have a hypothetical sort of dosing frequency for patients at this point, or is something to be tested?
Yeah, I can speak to that. Based on the preclinical data, it appears that the half-life for the OTC enzyme itself is approximately 12 days. So what we speculate is that the dosing will translate nicely into humans under that assumption that the half-life is similar for the actual OTC enzyme itself that's being generated by the messenger RNA therapeutic. So dosing could be once every 2 weeks, but it could be much more attractive once a month or even less frequent than that. And it'll be interesting to see how that data clarifies as we enter the clinic.
And the last question here is a little bit forward-looking question, which is that they're currently different ammonia scavengers available. Do you see the messenger RNA therapy as a replacement to that, or is a complement, or can those work together? How do you see the overall arching sort of treatment dynamics or landscape going forward, which obviously is very forward-looking?
All of the above. I think there's exciting opportunity that this mechanism could replace all therapies in theory. If we establish and reestablish healthy normal OTC levels, these patients could be dramatically impacted in their standard of living. Having said that, I think there's nothing wrong with letting the data drive that decision as well. Pat, any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, we ultimately, of course, all aim to restore the normal enzyme function. So if we do our job, we should remove any need for liver transplantation.
Okay, great. Thanks, and congrats on the data so far.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Patrick Dolezel of LifeSci Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. So for Dr. Feigen, is there any way to estimate the required levels of OTC protein that would ultimately be meaningful clinically? And I know there are some learnings from perhaps the care of females and patients with more mild phenotypes, but just wanted to hear your thoughts here. And then for the company, I was just kind of curious how you guys are thinking about this from a dosing perspective in the initial clinical study in terms of what levels of OTC activity you're aiming to achieve.
Sure. Dr. Feigenbaum, why don't you provide some initial thoughts?
I know that Pat and Joe mentioned 5 to 10% being the goal. I think if we can achieve higher than that, that would be even better. In an X-linked condition in the females, it's a little bit more complicated than in an autosomal recessive disease, obviously. So you're lionizing out different cells. But overall, the goal would be to improve ureagenesis and reduce ammonia. So I would agree 5 to 10% is probably okay. And it also depends how well one can measure enzyme activity. It's not an easy enzyme to measure activity. So I think the biochemical markers are going to be the answer. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's helpful. And perhaps given that the assays aren't super accurate, could you just speak to which biomarkers would be best to look at?
Yeah, I think we all use ammonia, amino acids, including glutamine, and urine orotic acid, maybe less reliable. But they would be the ammonia and the glutamine.
Yes, we definitely have a selection of biomarkers for this disease, which makes it attractive from a clinical progression perspective.
Great. And then I don't know if there's anything additional to add in terms of the dosing there.
First of all, from the corporate perspective, I think we have a more conservative aim to exceed that 10% threshold. All our preclinical data has been much higher than that, so we're cautiously optimistic, of course, that we can get this data repeated in humans. There's nothing more to add than what Dr. Feigenbaum commented on.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
It appears there are no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back to management for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you, operator, and thank you, everyone, for attending the call today. If there are any additional questions, please feel free to contact Arcturus directly. We hope to see many of you in January during JP Morgan. Till then, bye for now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.